It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Rob Farid.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, with falling divorce rates over the last 20 years, is the era of big divorce over?
First, the U.S. Department of Justice announced new restrictions on racial profiling by federal law enforcement today. The new guidelines are 5 years in the making and will apply to some national security activities for the first time.
Here to spell out these new racial profiling guidelines for us is Timothy Phelps. He's a Justice Department and Legal Affairs correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. Tim, welcome to Central Time.
Hello there.
Well, racial profiling is already illegal for federal law enforcement officials. What areas got expanded with these new rules?
Well, in addition to banning race and ethnicity, which had been in place for 11 years, they now ban law enforcement targeting characteristics including gender, religion, national orientation, national origin, sexual orientation, or gender identity.
And who will be following these new guidelines? What groups?
Almost all federal law enforcement personnel. Local law enforcement, like those involved in the recent shooting in Ferguson and the death in Staten Island, are not covered by this policy.
Now, there are some areas of the federal government, in terms of law enforcement, some agencies, some scenarios that don't have to follow these regulations. Tell us about the exceptions.
Yes, there are exceptions for certain activities of the Border Patrol working within 100 miles of the border, and the Secret Service, and the Transportation Security Administration working in screening at airports.
And what is the thinking behind why these people don't have to follow the new racial profiling rules?
Well, I think the thinking is that the situation, the threat of people to passengers on airplanes is so heightened and so precarious right now since 9/11. That taking in someone's religion or national origin may be necessary, as long as they tell me there are other characteristics that meet some defined security threat. And again, on the border, it's the same sense of heightened national security from people who are infiltrating into the country illegally.
Critics have said that because these don't apply to everyone, including screeners at airports and border checkpoints, that these are flawed guidelines and they don't really address problems and the need for reform. How has the Justice Department responded to that criticism?
Well, their response is that this does an awful lot more than what was there before. These new categories are quite an expansion. However, there are so many caveats, and not just the two that you mentioned, that civil rights leaders who've been pushing for this change feel that it's kind of one step forward and one step backward.
Now, these regulations have been in the works and under advisement for 5 years. They got released shortly after the unrest we've seen after the Ferguson case with Michael Brown and the death of Michael Brown and now Eric Garner. Do you see these regulations as a direct response to that in a way?
No, not a direct response. As you said, they've been in the works for 5 years, and really the reason they're being released now is that Eric Holder is about to retire as Attorney General. He's only going to be in this position for a few more weeks, probably. And it's something he very much personally wanted to get done before he left. The Justice Department is calling it one of his signature accomplishments.
It sounds like, though, the federal government is hoping that these new regulations will influence the way local law enforcement works eventually, that it will be sort of role model for local enforcement.
That's right. The Justice Department said that that Mr. Holder hopes that these regulations will be a model which will be followed by state and local law enforcement over time. There is one situation in which state and local officers are included, and that is if they are working on a task force with federal law enforcement.
How significant do you see these new regulations as being?
I think they're symbolically very significant. I think that there's so many caveats, including certain national security situations, that at least in the eyes of civil rights leaders, they don't fundamentally change the situation for people of color on the ground.
With all the caveats that you mentioned, is there concern that the enforcement of them could be unclear?
I all day been reading the 12 pages of guidance that have been issued, and it really is pretty hard to parse. So you wonder how an officer on the ground is going to be able to take it all into account in some difficult situation.
Is this seen as something that is finished, with a bow tied over the top, or is this something that you think will be tweaked in the days or months or even years to come?
Well, civil rights leaders are hoping that the president will step in and tell the Department of Homeland Security, to include Border Patrol and TSA. But frankly, this has been in the works for so long. It's been such a huge battle within the federal government that if it was going to happen, it would have happened while Holder was there in office in a position to influence the outcome.
Now, you've said that these are mostly symbolic guidelines. How different do you think federal law enforcement will be because of these guidelines?
Well, in some ways they're symbolic. In other ways, they're quite real. I mean, for people who are Muslim, for people who are from Yemen, those kinds of people will get more protection. And so I didn't mean to suggest that it was purely symbolic. It's just that there are a number of exceptions to these new protections, so that, for example, it still may be possible for an FBI agent to conduct undercover surveillance of a mosque, even if they don't have any evidence of illegal activity there.
Tim, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, you're very welcome.
We've been speaking with Timothy Phelps, Justice Department and Legal Affairs Correspondent for the Los Angeles Times.
The statistic that 50% of all marriages end in divorce has been floating around and believed to be true for years. But data show that divorce rates in the United States have actually been falling in the last 20 years. So, does this mean that the era of big divorce is over? And what's driving the drop in the divorce rate?
Stephanie Kuntz joins us now. She's the Director of Research on the Council on Contemporary Families. She's also the author of Marriage, A History, How Love Conquered Marriage. Stephanie, welcome back.
Thank you very much.
So, by now, everyone's pretty familiar with the statistic that about 50% of marriages end in divorce. Where does that statistic stand today?
Well, it was always a very complicated statistic, and one that really depended on a lot of factors. For one thing, marriage, your chance of divorce varies tremendously in terms of what age you marry, what your educational level is, and stuff. But it's true that it seemed as though in the late 1970s, about half of all marriages on average were ending in divorce before they reached their 50th anniversary. Since then, though, you're right, the divorce rate has been falling. The number of divorces relative to the number of married people has fallen by about 25% since its peak in 79. Marriages are lasting longer. People who married in the early 1990s, 70% of them reached their 15th anniversary, up from only 65% of those who married in the 70s and 80s. And marriages that were formed in the 2000s, we don't have the 15-year mark yet, but they seem to be on track for divorcing even less frequently.
It's interesting. It's been a shift, sounds like, from the 70s and 80s, and yet the statistic has been pretty persistent over the last decade or two, that 50% of marriages end in divorce. Why do you think it's been so hard to shake that conception?
Well, first of all, of course, bad news goes a lot further than good news most of the time. But secondly, it is true that the divorce rate is quite high, and I don't think we're turning that around. There's both good news and bad news hidden in this statistic about falling divorce rates. The good news is that a lot of the things that raised the divorce, the risk of divorce in the 70s, no longer do so, largely because of the spread of more egalitarian ideas. One ironic thing is that women's rights, women's new expectations, their entry into the workforce initially destabilized marriage. Now it seems to stabilize it. It's no longer a risk when a wife takes a job or when a couple marries at an older age than average, like it used to be. It's no longer a divorce risk when a wife has more education than her husband than it used to be. So we're seeing that people are adjusting, and actually marriages are improving. Domestic violence rates have fallen immensely in the last 30 or 40 years.
So that's the good news. What's the bad news?
Well, the bad news is that this decline is almost entirely driven by more educated couples. Divorce rates have increased or stayed high for less educated couples. And because many such couples don't marry, marriage is becoming more selective, and that's another good news, bad news thing. People no longer feel compelled to marry or rush into marriage just to have sex or even to have a baby, which means there's a longer search period, more intentionality, but it also means that many couples who are nervous about marrying cohabit, and their breakup rates are higher than the divorce rates indicate. So the fact, you know, we have two things going on here that are very interesting. The good news for marriage is what most people back in the 60s and 70s were afraid was going to be bad news, the increasing equality of women. That turns out to be great for marriages. We know that of marriages formed since the early 1990s, not only are they less likely to divorce, the most egalitarian ones are the ones who report the highest level of marital satisfaction and, yes, sexual satisfaction as well. But, of course, we have another counter trend. Just as there's more equality between men and women, there's more inequality between the classes. And there's been a big increasing gap. In the 1950s, marriage rates were basically the same for all educational and income levels. And, in fact, high school-educated women were more likely to marry than college-educated women. They were the least likely. Now, college-educated women and high-earning women are actually more likely to marry in the past. They're the most likely to marry. They're the least likely to divorce. But as we get an increasing gap between the haves and have-nots, we're also seeing a gap between the I do's and the I do nots, and the ones who can make it last and the ones who can't.
So what kinds of things are destabilizing marriages or preventing marriages at all among people with a lower economic bracket?
Well, there's two things at work here, and one of them that most people emphasize is there have been cultural changes. It is no longer considered so terrible to have a child out of wedlock, or at least there are none of the legal stigma that there used to be. This could tempt some people into having a child unnecessarily, or at least without thinking about it well, but it also saves divorces in the long run because shotgun marriages are very unstable and unhappy. But more, so you get this new kind of freedom that women can support themselves, unlike the 1950s and 60s, that there's less legal stigma and social stigma for having a child out of wedlock. And that coincides with the fact that it's more important than ever to have a two-earner marriage. And first of all, now men want women who have earnings potential, just as women have always wanted men with earnings potential. But even from a woman's point of view, it's much more complicated than the past. Back in the 1940s and 50s, if you were a high school educated woman or less than high school, you could marry almost any man in your community. And because, first of all, you couldn't get a job that paid anything for yourself, so you kind of needed to marry that guy. But also, you could expect him to get steady wage rises. The high school educated men, the traditional working class, their real wages were rising 1 to 2% a year. The average man of that type doubled his real earnings between moving from age 25 to 35. Now we have a completely different situation. Job insecurity is increasing. Real earnings have been falling steadily for the past 30 years. And a woman has to say to herself, well, yes, a second earner would be great because I still earn less money than men, but I can support myself if I need to, and I have to weigh that against the fact that I might marry a guy who loses his job and is just another mouth to feed, or someone who reacts to the chronic economic stress of this insecurity by misusing our resources, by drug abuse or alcohol abuse or infidelity. And so marriage has higher rewards for educated couples. Dual earner egalitarian educated couples are the most materially well off, and they seem to be the most happy. But it also carries risks for less educated, more economically insecure people.
Well, to stick with economics for a moment, I believe that I read that people who were in higher socioeconomic brackets no longer married outside that bracket as much as they used to. So if you're someone in one of those upper brackets, you're more likely to marry there rather than mixing it up between the different socioeconomic classes.
Yes, that's a big change. You know, the old stereotype of the doctor who married the nurse, the executive who married the secretary. Well, now doctors marry other doctors. And that means that you've got a double whammy in terms of socioeconomic inequality. The professional, highly educated people who have the most earnings potential are the most likely for the women to continue working, so they've got two high incomes to compete with less educated couples who only have one earner, and outbid them for things like decent homes and stuff. So that certainly exacerbates inequality. On the other hand, it certainly increases gender equality. Women with higher earnings potential, whether they work or not, get more housework, more childcare from their husbands. They have more clout in their marriage.
Now, one area we haven't talked about, what about older adults and their divorce rate? Maybe people over 55, 60?
Well, that's another good news, bad news statistic. The good news is that people are living longer lives. They're less likely to end their marriages by widowing. You know, people have got a longer time to stay together. But the other side of it is they're less likely to put up with empty shell marriages. As people live longer, active lives, if you're healthy and active at age 65, you can expect to live another 20 years. And that makes staying together till death do us part sort of a challenge for marriages that may not be high conflict, but, you know, sort of there's not much left. Well, you know, I interviewed women who were married in the 1950s and 60s, and one of them told me that we had a saying that she said, you're fat at 40 and finished at 50. Well, nobody feels that way anymore. So if you reach 50 today and you're in an unsatisfying marriage, there's considerable incentive to leave it. Divorce rates for people over 50 have doubled since 1980 and tripled for people over age 65. And again, good news, bad news. The possibility, these are often amicable splits, the kids are growing, the opportunities for older people to repartner have never been greater. But the bad news is that there's less time to recoup financial losses or rebuild social networks. And the first tends to be a problem for women, and the second tends to be a problem for men.
Do those people who may be part of the gray divorce demographic, do they tend to remarry?
Not so much. We don't have most recent statistics about what's happening with remarrying marriages, and I'm hoping to be able to get some information as to whether remarriage rates are going up or down. Generally, though, they although they often do repartner, they're more likely to cohabit. In fact, elders are the fastest growing group of cohabitors in the country.
So now that marriage may not be the best barometer of families in the United States, what is?
Well, there's a lot of debate about that. And clearly we have, there's a tremendous increase in family diversity. There's no longer a typical average family. You know, it used to be in the 50s, that you could pretty much guess that if you looked at a family, they would have two or three kids and a male breadwinner and a stay-at-home mom. Now you've got childless married couples, you've got cohabiting couples with kids, you've got same-sex couples, some of them legal and some of them not. You have dual-earner families, you've got single-parent families, you've got step-families. And increasingly, I think that we're being forced to say that a family is whoever you decide you've got to make those obligations to. And we're also finding, and this is the piece of good news in there, despite all the disruption and challenges by these very rapid changes, that the way a family functions is more important than its actual family structure. And so I think it's really important to redirect the conversation to help families function better, whatever their form.
We're talking right now with Stephanie Kuhn. She's the director of research on the Council on Contemporary Families, and she's also the author of the book Marriage, A History, How Love Conquered Marriage. Talking about that old statistic that everybody's heard, that 50% of marriages end in divorce, it's still being trotted out today, but the thing is it's not true anymore, and divorce rates have been falling over the last 20 years. This is, our guest says, a good news, bad news story, and we'd love to know what you think about this. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. We're talking with Stephanie Kuntz. She's the Director of Research on the Council on Contemporary Families. Chances are you've heard the statistic that 50% of marriages end in divorce. Well, it's not true anymore. Divorce rates have been falling for the last 20 years.
And we'd love to hear from you on this. Why do you think marriages today are staying together longer? If you waited longer to get married yourself, like a lot of people do today, do you think it's helped you choose a better partner? Or do you think that instead maybe you'll choose never to get married? And what kind of partnership are you looking for in your would-be partner in a modern marriage? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We go to our phones now. Anthony joins us first in Green Bay. Hey, Anthony.
Hello, ladies.
What do you think about the marriage question right now?
Well, I think that I'm 30 years old, and I waited because just because I was into a girl at some point in my 20s doesn't mean I always would be. And I had that foresight. And so people change as they get older. So why make a lifelong commitment when you're still developing?
Okay,
that's why I think people are waiting.
Gotcha. Thanks, Anthony. And Stephanie, what about that? Is there some sort of sense that people are choosier now and that maybe because of online dating, maybe other factors, people don't want to settle down right away, especially maybe like Anthony when they're in their 20s?
Oh, for sure. That's a very big factor. Now, it's interesting. It used to be in 1960, the average age of marriage for a woman was 20 years and 2 months before she could even drink champagne at her wedding. And the average age for men was 22. People who married much earlier or much later than that had a much higher chance of divorce. Now, early marriage is still, and even more so, a risk for divorce. But one thing that has really changed, and it's very interesting, is that every year you postpone marriage right up into your early 30s, you lower your chance of divorce. I think that's partly because of having time to know yourself better and to learn more what you want in a partner. It's also, I think, because a lot of that delay comes as people get higher education, which increases their economic stability and their emotional resources. They learn better negotiation skills. They learn more deferred gratification. These are all things that are important in modern marriages in a way they weren't in the 1950s, when the typical advice was to a woman was, just do whatever your husband wants you to do.
Well, Anthony, thanks a lot for the call. We appreciate that. And you can join our conversation at 800-642-1234. If you could put your finger on it, what would you say about why marriage rates are declining right now? Do you see this as a good news story or a bad news story? Our guess is there's a little of both. 800-642-1234. And we go now to Jack joining us in Baraboo. Hi, Jack.
Hi, did you say marriage rates are declining or divorce rates are
declining?
Sorry,
divorce rates. Good catch. Divorce
rates.
Both
are declining.
Well, my answer would be I think there's more information about how to do marriage well. And I think that's precipitating or reducing the divorce rates because people know how to do it better. I'm a baby boomer born in 1949. My parents' marriage was a train wreck. And by 1960, they were divorced. I pretty much grew up without any example of how to have a marriage. I have had one marriage, and I'm divorced. And after about 40 years of studying how marriages work, I might marry again. And I would offer this to the guests. I would say that the best marriages, the ones where the two partners are happiest and the most fulfilled in the marriages, have happened for countless generations. It's only that in the past 50 or 80 years or so that we've studied and written about them.
Great. Well, thank you, Jack. Lots of good points there. And he's saying one of the points there, Jack, making is that there's more information now about how to have a successful marriage. And in the past, there may not have been any sort of education other than trial and error and the hoping for the best. Do you think that's true, Stephanie?
Well, it may be partly true, but I think that more important is the fact that what we want out of marriage is changing. I mean, back in the 1950s and 60s, you know, I interviewed a lot of people who were married in those days. And, you know, the average length of courtship was only 6 months. And basically, you were looking, you didn't have any alternatives. You would say, well, it was time to settle down. Or the woman would sometimes say, well, that's just what you did. That's all. I didn't want to become an old maid. And so you really married, in one sense, a gender stereotype rather than a real individual. And all the messages that there were about how to make marriage work involved very strict division of labor, that it was bad for the man. One sociologist wrote that a man who liked to change diapers might be legitimately suspected of having a little too much inner fat on his inner thigh. And a woman was told, you know, if she said she suspected her husband of infidelity, therapists would often say, well, are you keeping yourself well-groomed enough? Are you paying attention to his friends rather than your own? So there was a whole different thing that was necessary to make marriages work. And nowadays we expect much more of marriage. And sometimes the expectations may be unrealistic, but on the whole, we try to live up to those expectations better than the past because we expect more equality and intimacy.
Now, you were saying that marriage rates themselves are also falling, divorce rates falling, but marriage too, so fewer people are getting married in general.
Well, yes. Now, marriage rates are complicated because if you count all the people over 18 who how many of them are married and how many of them are not, you're obviously, the marriage rate's going to fall as the age of marriage rises. So the question is, how many of these people will never marry? And I think most demographers now think that it could be somewhere between 15 and 20 to maybe even 25% of people who remain single. I'm not sure about that because the spread in the age of marriage is also increasing, and people are marrying for the first time at the age of 50 and even 60 at times. So it's hard to say. There's certainly more lifelong singlehood than in the past, but marriage is by no means dead. And as many of your callers have pointed out, the fact that people are taking longer to marry and being more selective and not just marrying because they're running out, they go, what's the only way I can have sex and be respectable? These marriages are stronger. The couples know each other better. They know themselves better.
We'll go next to Sean. Sean is joining us in Spooner. Hi, Sean.
Hi. You know, I would love to get married someday, but as a child of divorce, I really, really, look for the advocacy of the children, because I wouldn't want my children to go through that.
So when you say you look for the advocacy of the children, are you saying that you want to make sure you're with a good partner so that divorce is not something the children have to go through?
Correct. I mean, I work with high school students every single day, and, you know, the majority that I work with are at risk, so I see it every single day. So, I mean, it's more something that I want to prevent my own children from having to go through.
I see. Well, thank you. Thanks for sharing that, Sean. Do you think a lot of people take that into consideration, Stephanie, when they're choosing a life partner? Do they think about what could happen to the children they might have?
Well, I think that many people are afraid of divorce. I mean, that's one of the things that we see when we interview low-income couples and say, why are you not marrying? And they say, well, I'd almost rather be a single parent than go through the process of divorce because they've seen how hard it can be. And in fact, people really ought to look ahead to what happens if things go sour. I mean, when people ask me if they should have a prenuptial agreement, I often say, well, not just about money. You should agree what you'll do if you start to disagree and how you'll respond to the kids. And that's another little piece of good news, is that more couples are divorcing amicably. And we actually know that a couple that divorces, that does not do the all the bad things that people used to do in the middle of divorces, and some people still do, that tell secrets, ask the children to take sides, engage in conflict, fight over the custody, have the child change schools halfway through the school year, which is actually a real risk factor, especially for adolescents. These kids can do fine, and in some cases they do better than if they were stuck in a high conflict or even a cold but contemptuous marriage. So there's no reason to assume the worst. You should think through the bad possibilities and then figure out how to move forward in your life, and you don't have to avoid marriage because of this fear.
Stephanie, your book is called Marriage, A History, How Love Conquered Marriage. Is love still the main reason that people are getting married, if not, you know, old-fashioned reasons like acquiring a piece of land or a herd of horses, which we assume does not happen anymore? Are people still just getting married for love, or are there more practical concerns that are bundled with it?
Well, there's always more practical concerns that are bundled with it. But the argument of my book is that for thousands of years, marriage was stable because it was a way of getting in-laws and getting advantageous in-laws, getting social respect, expanding your family labor force. For the upper classes, sometimes you even sealed peace treaties and military alliances with it. And when love became a legitimate, respectable reason, and young people began to be encouraged to choose their own mates rather than have parents do it, and to choose them on the basis of love, on the one hand, it became more possible to build loving relationships and to, you know, to look for happiness in your life, but it also became more possible to say, well, if the love dies, maybe we should leave. And divorce rates and love matches rose hand in hand throughout history. Now, I think most people do marry for love in a way that's much more profound than it was as late as the 1960s, when a poll of 2/3 of college women said they would consider marrying someone they didn't love if the man met all the other criteria, including being able to support them and this sort of thing. Nowadays, people are looking for love. I think the real challenge for us is to figure out what we mean by love. Our definitions of love were forged in the 19th century, when there were these huge differences between men and women. Women looked for men who were taller, older, wiser, more educated, higher earning, a little scary because they knew things that you didn't know. And men looked for women who were compliant, who looked up to them, who were all nurturing. And today, you know, love, that can lead to an initial attraction. But love has to be based on something much more profound than gender differences. It has to be much more individualized friendship. So I think people are marrying for love, and that we're engaged in a long, protracted process of figuring out what love means in a world where men and women are equal and do very similar things rather than being totally specialized.
We leave it there. Stephanie, thank you so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
We've been speaking with Stephanie Kuntz, the Director of Research on the Council on Contemporary Families. She's also the author of Marriage, A History, How Love Conquered Marriage.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we take stock of the number of gun homicides in Wisconsin this year and look at how one police department is trying to stem gun violence through voluntary home inspections.
First, it's time for Wisconsin life. Before California was the center of the American wine universe, the Midwest loomed large. Wisconsin had vineyards and wineries before the Civil War. Historian Erica Hanekel shares the history of wine in this region.
From about the 1830s through the 1870s, the Ohio Valley is really the center of wine growing in the U.S. I think this is something that not a whole lot of Americans know. I think we think that it was California, and it always was California, and there was nothing before California. And so this middle part of the 19th century is really filled with Midwestern wine growing. So, of course, Wisconsin has a deep beer history, and that's really coming on the backs of German immigrants. But German immigrants are also the ones largely doing a whole lot of the labor in the vineyards in the 19th century. The wine scene in Wisconsin really starts up about a decade and a half after brewing starts in Wisconsin. Brewing is really up and going by the 1830s. Wine comes to Wisconsin in 1846, or at least the story that gets told about the progenitor of wine was a guy by the name of Augustin Herázy. He was a Hungarian. He had all of these entrepreneurial schemes that he brought to America with him. And Augustin Herázy founds a winery in Wisconsin, very near Prairie du Sac, and it's actually what later becomes the Wollersheim Winery. But Herázy only stays in Wisconsin for 2 years. He moves to Sonoma, California in 1848, as you might guess, because gold had been found in Northern California. So he had to go and start up a couple of other schemes. And so after that point, for many decades, you have essentially several different types of families growing grapes in southern Wisconsin. By 1908, the University of Minnesota, their grape breeding program begins. And that really brings types of grapes that grow well in the upper Midwest onto the market for grape growers. So then, sadly, of course, Prohibition hits in the 1920s, and it takes many decades, again, for Wisconsin to really kind of get its momentum back on the whole. It's not until the 1970s that winemaking, I would say, really begins to take off. Ever since, we've had a really pretty lovely dramatic increase, and really over the last couple of years. So today, we've got now, 700 acres of vines in Wisconsin, approximately. There are several places across the Midwest that do make wine and sparkling wines out of grapes that were particular to the Midwest in the 1800s. So the Catawba, Concord grapes were popular on the East Coast and in the Midwest. The Niagara grape, the Delaware grape. These are kind of specific grapes. Well, I have not tasted all of those. I'm definitely not a 19th century wine expert in terms of taste. I have tried sparkling Catawba, and I think it's actually great. There are lots and lots of wine snobs that will tell you, nothing from the Labrusca family of grapes is going to be drinkable, that it's all swill. And I just don't believe that.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television. For more information, visit wisconsinlife.org.
We're joined by Erica Hanekel. She's author of Empire of Vines, Wine Culture in America. Erica, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, you mentioned a central figure in the history of wine in Wisconsin is Augustin Herázy, but you also mentioned he only stayed here for 2 years, yet his legacy has remained with us since then. Why are those 2 years so profound?
I think it's because he promotes his own story so well. He is one of those 19th century characters that variously comes to be known as a count and as a colonel in his translation from Hungary to America. He definitely was not a count, and there are mixed interpretations of the history as to whether or not he was a colonel ever. And so it's kind of hard to separate fact from fiction on the Herázy front. He's one of these guys that has this really impressive mustache. He's dressed in flamboyant colors. He acts very aristocratically, but he's not of the nobility from Hungary. And so he kind of acts in this kind of showman sort of way throughout Wisconsin. And so he lands in Prairie du Sac, kind of founds Sauk City, and he starts up with all different kinds of schemes. He starts up a brickyard, he starts up a sawmill, he's got a general store, he's got a hotel, he's selling lots to other new immigrants, he's got a ferry and steamboat operation. He's got sheeps and pigs. He's also growing the first hop yard in Wisconsin. And part of this kind of showmanship, this sort of I can do everything all at once, he's telling stories about himself that include stories like him killing a wolf with his bare hands.
Wow.
That kind of grows into killing several different wolves with his bare hands.
Well, just to jump in a little bit, Wisconsin these days is known as a beer state. Was wine more prominent in the early days with settlers?
You know, by the numbers, I don't believe that it was. Wine was never as popular in the U.S., really anywhere, as, you know, as popular as beer or as whiskey, really, alternatingly. We do have various early Wisconsin immigrants, basically in their religious practices and cultural lifeways, that are bringing their wine culture with them. So, of course, the Norwegians and the Swedes and the Poles are all kind of bringing their alcoholic kind of traditions with them. But as with most things alcohol-related in Wisconsin, it's probably best to focus on those German immigrants, the German population. So winemaking and brewing kind of begin in Wisconsin in the 1840s. By the 1890s, we see that most communities had a brewery, and far fewer than that, we do see wineries. But these wineries are largely staffed by German immigrants. And so usually they're more the laborers still at this point in the mid-century because they're kind of new immigrants. They don't have the sort of capital to come in and buy things. But they're more the laborers than the owners. But they also do often prove to be the best buyers of the products that they are laboring to make, and that includes wine as well as beer. You know, I'm sure most people in Wisconsin sort of know that by the mid-19th century, we see places like Milwaukee is kind of a brewing king of the Midwest. We've got labels, you know, Pabst and Schlitz and all sorts of German brands dominating. And then by mid-century, you know, especially with colonists' outposts, we see alcoholic beverages basically kind of more popular than we might think in a time of rising ideas about prohibition. Of course, prohibition, again, doesn't start until about the 1920s, but there's sort of moments around that that come decades earlier where you see this ramp up to control of alcohol. And what that's usually pointing to is a control of immigrants at the same time. And, I mean, but on the other hand, alcohol is one of the very safest drinks to imbibe in sort of early, you know, quote-unquote frontier life, because fermented beer and wine kill the bacteria in the water. And so if you're going to be in a place that's kind of has an unreliable water supply, fermenting that is going to be your safest way around that.
And we leave it there. Erica, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, no problem.
We've been speaking with Erica Hanekel, Associate Professor of Environmental History at Northland College and the author of Empire of Vines, Wine Culture in America.